Oh, I accidentally picked on a scab in my last call.
Oh,
Got like this
no.
flapper on. You can't really tell
I
because I've
love
got
them.
it got like all this tattoo junk here, but oh, there you go. You can see it
Yeah, I
now.
can see it. Oh, well, that's
I'm naming this
sticking right up
Paul.
there.
Friday, and we are drunk and retired.
Yeah.
You mean that Paul? Nice.
That's little Paul there. It's just growing so big these days and got a little booger around him. Anyway, you so
but say hi, everybody.
Hi, everybody.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to another wonderful edition of whatever we're calling it this week.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So what's happening? I mean, JJ, where's your head at? What are you curious about?
So I might as well just say it.
Congratulations.
All right.
You're pregnant.
No. Yeah. Right.
Again?
One of those times in your career where you've put some time and effort into something and you're really, really, really excited to try to get something working out and you're confident that everything's making progress, everything's going great. And then you get that call and you get that little working session and you discover that it's impossible. And you feel like you've let down your management and your teammates and things like that. It's one of those career things that happen. It's not like I've lost my job or anything. It's nothing that bad. It's just I put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into trying to figure this thing out. And I was informed today that it's scrapped. It's just like they don't need me anymore. They've just decided it was taking either too much time or too much effort. And we're just moving on. So that's where my head at is at. And I know that hopefully our listeners or our friends who pay attention to this podcast I hope they've never felt it, but they have felt it. They can kind of understand that little underpinning in my voice today. So, yeah. How about y'all? How are you doing, Broberg?
Well, that's real, man. I want to just acknowledge that you shared that. That's awesome that you did share it. Sucks that you're going through it, but I love how you framed it up that like we have all had something that we threw a lot of energy into and we cared a lot about that got canceled, defunded. We got fired before we got to do it. All of the above. Like that
got donated to a foundation that isn't a real foundation.
Zing. Oh, wow.
Are you feeling a little Istio pain, Paul? Like, have you been
contributing? No, not at all.
It's not written in Java.
I'm taking a wild swing at what JJ might be talking about.
No, actually it's not. It's not directly related to that announcement. I'm only tangentially involved there.
When you started at IBM, you were pretty heavily digging into Istio, so I thought that might be a thing.
No. It turns out it's another project, but it's interestingly timed. And it, actually, great segue. CZ, how about you describe what was just announced about Istio and all the kerfuffle, I think is the correct word to determine, and of all the different thought leaders being freaking out right now.
Yeah, I didn't follow it too closely. I just saw some like people like open source lawyering each other on Twitter about it. Mm-hmm. But I think Matt is our resident father of the five freedoms. And so maybe he might be better off explaining what's going on. My understanding is that Google created a new foundation and donated Istio to it, or is in the middle of donating Istio to it, which
and
isn't
Angular
necessarily unlike what they did with CNCF.
Not true.
Hold on. Hold on. I got to make the joke. Isn't it GNU freedom? Sorry. It's timing was off, but come on.
You got to like leave some white space in there for us to laugh too. Okay.
Anyway, go ahead.
You've had a GNU freedom revoked right there. So that aside, yeah. I mean, Paul, you brought this to my attention. I have not been hanging out in the Twitter fights today, But it is interesting that Google did announce a new third-party organization that can own both trademarks of open source projects as well as own the rights to the copyright, that even though it's licensed open source, it's ultimately owned by some entity. And this new entity is called Open Usage Commons. So right now, the projects listed on the site are Istio, Angular, and Garrett Code Review. The third being one that no one wants to use.
Yes! Yes!
But
I'm surprised Garrett's in there, because that's part of the OpenStack Foundation, isn't it?
Tell that to this part of the internet? I didn't know. Oh, I forgot you two OpenStacked for a while. That's something I boldly avoided.
No. Garrett has never been part of it was heavily used by OpenStack, but it was always its own project. And it was one of those weird things that when you actually started digging into it, you're like, wow, there's a whole world underneath this and nobody ever talks about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I only use it to open a patch to the Go programming language. And that was a trip. Anyway, so I guess the kerfuffling, as you're putting it, is that there's a sense that Istio should go to the CNCF since they maintain all the cloud native-y things. And that was kind of the plan early on. And then there's some not public conversations about what's the motivation, what is their attention around what happened with Kubernetes, where it was so successful and Google couldn't capture as much of that energy as they quote unquote deserved. And are they avoiding that with Istio, or is that actually not related and we're just looking for a fight? Definitely interesting. But so I would say what's distinctly different is that CNCF is an independent body in the sense that the board is separate from just Google execs and Google people. And the code base is in a separate organization, and the actual management of the projects are like not owned by a certain company. It's managed through CNCF. So it does provide some distance from a single entity.
Well, and I guess, the Linux Foundation does do so much for giving back to Linux and giving back to open source, right?
Yeah, I think it's really popular to shit on these organizations, and I'm someone who's like, this is open governance, which reminds me of how people talk about governments in general. It's like people love to shit talk and don't show up and do the fucking work themselves. So I'm going to say you do a better job or kindly get over yourself.
Right. Yeah. That is fair.
Yeah. With all the love in the world, Paul.
I was just trying to like lead a question for you and see where it went. I don't have a strong opinion either way. Well, I'm not one of the people that get up late at night and scream on Twitter about how terrible they are.
Let me ask this question though, because this is a valuable question to that show up and do the work. There's a lot of people out there that I know that would love to do that. Like they would, but they don't know where to go. Because a lot of these, let me break it down how I see it and tell me first of all if I'm wrong, and how I could be better educated on this, or if I'm right, then we have a fundamental problem that I'm going to get to in just a second. So the CNCF, okay, let's just say it's the CNCF and I want to become more active in that community, right? I want to say that and plus my job, I'm privileged enough, it's a privilege to be able to work on open source and sit that in the job I have at IBM. Yeah. Now, do I go to a bunch of IRC meetings to like start paying attention to people like we used to be in the day? Or is there a Slack team that I'm supposed to join? Or who do I poke to say, hey, I'm a resource that I want to be active here? Because there's never an obvious path, right? So, and the board, hold on one last time, the boards, like the actual governing, 9 out of 10 times are bought into, right? Where you have to put like a $10,000 or $100,000 donation from a company, and then congratulations, you get slot A on the board where you can help do the governance and things like that. Are we talking two different things here too? Like, do you see where I'm coming from? Like, I don't know.
So we're talking at least two things, but keep going.
With the CNCF at least, Their board does have absolutely like commercial sponsor members, but they also purposefully have community members that have sort of bubbled up through the community to try and avoid being that you have to buy in. Also, I guess for the getting different people involved at that governance level. As far as getting in, they absolutely do have like new contributor like stuff. There is a SIG dedicated to like community and to new contributors. And you do obviously you do need to have to figure out how to go and find them. At the end of the day, you basically have to find the IRC meetings or Zoom meetings and start showing up to them. So what you said right at the start was absolutely the correct thing to do. It's pretty easy to find the list of SIGs. And I know there's folks that are working like really hard on that new contributor experience, whether it's people wanting to just contribute code or whether people are wanting to be more involved in the community. It also helps to know somebody who's plugged in. So if you were to happen to have some friends that wore red hats that were really well tied into the community, it would be a good idea to ask them to help you like figure out.
IBM wrote Istio, so there's connection there too.
Okay, so obviously I'm not talking about myself, right? Because I'm saying that it's for an audience member who might find themselves in that position.
Yeah.
So
I was using you as that like proxy for that person, right? Yeah. So if you want to, chances are someone that wants to contribute to Kubernetes probably knows somebody who's in that community already and should seek to like figure out how they did it and maybe get a little bit of like mentorship or whatever through that person if they can.
So yeah, I think it's important we don't misappropriate all governing bodies for all projects as if there is one set path to do all of it. So it starts with a lot of self-education, and I put the self in there on purpose. Like, how do you know how the CNCF builds its governing body? Google CNCF governing body and read the blog posts about it, read the source documentation about it and how they're made up of governing board members, end user community members. They have a certain, what the hell do they call it? The technical oversight committee that you can get into. It's its own thing, which is different from how you two have been scarred by the guidance around the OpenStack community, which my understanding is CNCF is a very different structure when it comes to the pay-to-play versus OpenStack. Yes, some seats on governing boards are due to sponsorships, but they don't guarantee that your patches are going to get into a project or like they're going to change the release cycle in the same way that these things are. So there's allegedly a decoupling of who's governing the board and who's governing the project. So back to your initial question of like, how do you, example person listening to this podcast, get involved? It is damn hard. It's a lot of work to go. I mean, I could say like Google it, but like that's not actually the end of it, because like there's a understanding the social graph of people that are influential in a given space and then working your way into that. There's educating yourself on the history of open source, because whether you recognize it or not, you're going to get tested on that indirectly through conversations, and people will judge you for not knowing it. Felt that one pretty hard for a couple years. And then there's like, how do you get paid to do it so you have enough time to actually show up to all these meetings? Like that is a master's class in kind of bending your career towards what you're interested in. But I hope I'm part of the contributor experience SIG for Kubernetes. And I hope we provide a really good place for people to show up and say like, I need to do something or I want to do something. What do I do? And then be able to distribute people into the Kubernetes ecosystem to start building stuff. So if you really don't know what you're doing and you are interested in the space that we talk about, that's a really great option. There's also a contributor ladder in the Kubernetes community. But then I think let's be real. I struggle with the paradox of choice here, where there's so mm-hmm. many ways in which we can contribute that I end up just kind of fiddling with looking through the libraries of stuff I could contribute to and then just end up like watching Netflix. Do you, either yeah, of you suffer with that? Like, how do I choose one freaking thing?
My biggest problem is I don't have a lot of really strong opinions about like the technical implementations of a lot of the stuff. And therefore it's kind of hard for me to say, okay, I'm going to be all in on cluster API and I'll become like super duper expert at cluster API and contribute to that. I'm more of the like poke and prod at all these other things, all these different things around, and just like, you know, seagull, like fly in, poke at some stuff, throw some commits in, and then like fly off and go and do some other stuff. And I think, I mean, I guess because that's how I tend to do it, I feel like that sort of contribution is very valid, but I also feel like it's very difficult if that's who you are, if like that's how you're doing stuff, to actually feel like a member of the community.
Right. Well, yeah, what's it mean to be a member of something? Right. Like, yeah, you do kind of have to show up over and over again and mm-hmm. have it, and you have to let it into a space where it's part of your identity. And I haven't really done that since the virtualization community. Mm-hmm. Like, where it's like, oh, I'm part of this V community because I was so young in my career and there's such a good group of people in that space. And Twitter was like our own little playground for a bit, where like it just felt really healthy and like the thing I did. But I'm like Kubernetes adjacent, and I'm like Python foundation adjacent, like open source adjacent with my work. Like, but yeah, I feel you, Paul. Like, I don't know if it's the time commitment or just the lack of choosing just one place to be. Like, can you be home if you're trying to chase all three places at once?
Right.
I agree about that paralyzation of choice statement that you made. Yeah. Because like, honestly, I get bored really easily, right? I'm whatever they call a T-space engineer or whatever, where you're like really, really broad in things and only one or two things you ever get really deep, because that's the way I learn, the way I think, right? And the Kubernetes community as an organization, as a community, as an entity, is too big for me. It scares me away. The ecosystem of landscape.cncf.io, I look at that every once in a while. And I even had some interns show up over this last couple weeks, and they're like, hey, we want to help out with the CNCF or CNCF projects. What can we do? Screen shared, showed the landscape and saying, you have a lot of choices here. And they're like, oh my God. And it's true, because there's just so much in that world, where I realized I just used Kubernetes and CNCF as synonyms there. But in a lot of ways, it's kind of like saying, you know, Kleenex and tissue. They kind of fall, like, pedantically I'm wrong, but vernacularly speaking, there's a lot of intersection there. And I don't know what to do. Like, I use this, that seagull analogy is a great way of describing it, Paul, where like you come in, you help where you can, and then you go find something else the next day. But it doesn't, you don't really have ownership of anything. And maybe that's where I'm getting here, getting to this statement is, I don't feel like I own part of the Kubernetes ecosystem. I don't feel like it's part of my identity. Is that what that badge is for? The contributor badge is to identify that as an owner? Like, because it's really coveted, right? Or no?
So that's weird to me in only, I guess, in one sense, that like, I felt really like that the virtualization stuff I was just saying was part of my identity when I own none of the code. Mm-hmm. It was all proprietary, and yeah, like I didn't even own the documentation. I couldn't even like edit documentation because it wasn't open source. So like there wasn't a sense of communal ownership about it. But so I really trace back to like, so what does it mean to be part of a community in some meaningful mm-hmm. way? And that is so much has something to do with what the community is offering, but also what you're willing to accept. Mm-hmm. And you have to ask yourself, like, where am I in that process of, like, are you at a point in your life where you're looking for an identity from, like, from a project that's related to work that has to do with pushing bits across cloud computing resources? Like, that's not for everybody right now. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just, like, where it's a little real, a little bit more vulnerable than maybe we intended for this podcast, but, like, would we really be doing this if all of us were independently wealthy? Like, would we be caring about how Kubernetes works?
No.
I'd probably be grilling more.
Yeah.
on the beach in Fiji.
Yeah, and reading a ton of philosophy that hurts my head. Yeah, that's satisfying. Anyway, so why don't you feel like you're part of a community? I would say it's a relationship. It's as much to do with you as the community. Mm-hmm. More than any, Kubernetes is so good at being open-armed and, like, letting people in. And you could claim that hat of, I am a Kubernetes contributor and I do everything Kubernetes, and you don't have to do a damn thing. You just have to say it. Like, they're not, no one's checking your credentials. Yeah. So that's really up to you. I do have commit access because of the stuff I'm doing with a couple working groups. I don't feel that special. I don't feel like it's really sunk in a meaningful way. It was exciting for a minute, but I don't know, man. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, work. I think that's what you said was kind of really important around, like, do you really want it to become part of your identity? I think that's what hit me, is, like, I'm definitely not at that point where I want Kubernetes to be part of my identity. But then I also don't want to feel like I'm excluded because I don't want that.
Yeah. I feel like that's a healthy place to chill.
Yeah. The other thing I was going to say is, like, not being that and being the seagull type contributor tends to mean that you don't get a lot of stuff actually merged in.
Yeah.
Because by the time someone looks at it and is going to review it and stuff, it could be weeks later and you've moved on to the next thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you really need to have some, like, real, like, I really like this real push to, like, follow through on your contributions. Like, I made a contribution to, like, OAuth 2 proxy and had it all working. It was all great. There was some nitpicking, got it all sorted out. And then it just sat there and no one looked at it for, like, 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. And then it was, like, so badly out of date with master and needed a bunch of rebasing and had all these merge conflicts. And I was like, I just couldn't. Like, I've moved on from this problem. I've, like, found other ways of doing what I need to do. Like, just the effort required to, like, reshape this and get it through when it wasn't particularly welcome in the first place. Like, I just moved on. And I've, like, that is not an uncommon thing to happen for me.
Common. Yeah, it's super normal. I would even say it's one of the greatest lies we tell people in our space, right? that pull, like, request, hey, accepted. Yeah, and that, like, oh, you're an open source now, you should pull request everything you're doing, you're gonna be great.
Right.
I'm like, the only consistent contribution that just, it can hang out for a while and is generally merged eventually is documentation, because mm-hmm. most of the project maintainers couldn't be bothered to keep that up to date, and I can't blame them, it's a ton of crap. Mm-hmm. But code contributions can get pretty tricky, and then, like, there's so much to be said about, like, how people don't want your code because then it's their code and then they have to maintain the way you wrote the code, right? And they want to refactor it to theirs.
What do they say, open source is like a puppy, right? You get a puppy and it could be for free, but you still got to take care of it. Right.
Oh, I thought you meant you kick it and it keeps coming back.
It just shits on the floor.
don't kick puppies, children.
That's definitely the theme of the show, is do not kick puppies.
What else have people been up to?
Crickets.
Wow, crickets.
Yeah.
So last night I made a chocolate mousse, and it's actually a technique I learned ages back and had kind of forgotten. And it is purely like you melt chocolate and water, and then you whisk the shit out of it over an ice bath.
How do you melt water? Yeah,
like this. Well, you melt the chocolate in the water.
Oh, like you're blowing my mind, man. How many states are we dealing with
Jack
here?
Wagon. You jack wagon. Don't you mess with me. So you basically, you take boiling water, you add your little like chocolate buttons or whatever kind of melting chocolate you're using. In the right ratio, it's like a little bit more chocolate than water. And then when it's fully melted, you put it like in another bowl with ice in it. And then you just whisk it for like 10 minutes. And what happens is you're kind of agitating it enough to stop the chocolate crystals from setting up again or whatever. And it ends up at, when it hits the right temperature, sort of suddenly blooming up into like a foam.
Mm.
And so you get this sort of chocolate moussey kind of texture, but it's purely chocolate, right? So you're not, there's no cream, there's no gelatin, there's nothing there to kind of take away from the chocolate flavors.
That's absolutely wild.
You end up with like, you know, you use a really good chocolate, you end up with a chocolate mousse that tastes exactly like that really good chocolate. Whoa. And so last night I made that, and I substituted some of my Blanton's bourbon for the water. And so I had this like really, really tasty, like bittersweet chocolate Blanton's mousse that was so
That's
delicious.
Some expensive freaking chocolate right there with the Blanton's.
Well, here's the thing. I only had to use like a quarter of a shot. Cause like,
really?
Yeah, cause chocolate flavors pretty easily.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't have to use a ton. And like, I didn't want it to be like burn your mouth like alcohol, right? I just wanted that sort of back end of whiskey. And I could have picked
the burn going down your throat. Just a little burn.
I could have picked one of the cheap whiskeys, but I'm like, what the fuck? Like it's the end of the fucking world. I might as well do it with the good stuff.
Speaking of a little burn, you did just remind me. Thankfully he doesn't subscribe to the show, but a good friend of mine we're planning a surprise birthday party for. And he is as into the Hot Ones YouTube channel as I am. Mm-hmm. So I am buying an entire set of their hot sauces that range from 1,000 Scoville to 2 million Scoville, and planning a Hot Ones challenge of like lining up a set of chicken wings and asking intimate questions as we both kind of fade into oblivion from eating hot sauce that should not be consumed by human beings. So I'm like slightly terrified and really excited for this.
Yeah, that sounds like fun.
Yeah,
just make sure you're at least 6 feet apart.
Yeah, no, that's going to be very easy to be. Have either of you ever had like excessively hot sauces?
I dabble. I think I've got a bottle or two of like Carolina Reaper style hot sauces. When I was in Tokyo last, I went to a ramen shop that specializes in Oni level, which I think Oni is the Japanese word for devil. And you choose like your spice level 1 to 5 for chilies, but also for like your Szechuan peppercorns.
Yeah.
Except there's a Japanese equivalent called Sancho, which is basically that same prickly ash. And then they have like so 1 to 5 for both of those, and they have an Oni level and then like a double Oni level. And of course, being the clown I am, I like double Oni for both. And literally the entire top of the bowl was just like green Szechuan pepper powder. It wasn't the chili that did it. It was just the pure amount of Szechuan pepper. There was no way anyone's eating that and like feeling good.
Can you,
I sort of scraped off a lot of that, thankfully, because it was a ton of it was just on the top, and then it was edible. But oh boy, that was first spoonfuls before I took care of that was.
Give me the link to the TripAdvisor their page or something so we can put it in the show notes for.
Yeah, there's
actually to go traveling again.
There's a bunch of like YouTubers have gone and done it, but. When I look at my photo and I look at their photo, I'm like, you didn't do the proper double Oni level. You did the regular Oni level.
The regular Oni. That sounds absolutely insane. So this show climaxes with something called The Last Dab.
Yep.
And it is a...
I always like to climax with The Last Dab.
Oh, God. I really... I'm terrified for the boils on your private parts. This is what you're using. But yeah, the stuff is, it just looks like pure hell in hot sauce. And I think I'm gonna love this because like I also like still distinctly remember the moment that I bungee jumped and just like how terrified and exhilarating that was, and my understanding from hot sauces that are super hot, it kind of gives you that same sense of just like out of body experience.
Yeah.
So
it was... speaking of bungee jumping, so way like episodes and episodes back, we were joking around about LiveJournal and stuff, and I actually found my old LiveJournal, and
what?
There's not much on there, but there was my recounting of my parachuting episode where the chute didn't open.
Wow.
And so it was kind of fun rereading through that, like as it had just happened, and sort of reconciling my memory of it versus that. And it was still pretty close.
Damn. What,
so yeah, I don't recommend. I don't recommend skydiving and having your chute not open.
Yeah.
Thankfully, it eventually opened. Because the guy I was strapped to knew what he was doing. But we were the last ones out of the plane and we were the first ones to land by a long time.
Wow.
And my buddy paid to have the video, which is like an old VHS tape or something now because we're old. And you actually see in the background us just hurtling past.
How could you not buy your video though? Like that
must have been... you had to like pre-buy it because the guy literally had like a VHS like wrist like a Super 8 or whatever, like miniaturized, like attached to his wrist. This was like, it was on LiveJournal, so it was like in the late 90s, early 2000s.
He has a VHS recorder attached to his helmet, so
it wasn't quite that bad, but yeah.
Pretty close. That's incredible.
Yeah. Makes me think of that Justin TV all of a sudden.
What?
Did you never hear Justin.tv? No?
Nope.
So eventually got bought by Twitch or something. And Justin.tv was like one of the first times a guy tried to like walk around that. Like a camera constantly like walking around with him or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah, it was.
That's right. It was one of the first, like, you could sign up and, like, stream your own video to it and stuff somehow.
Yeah, something.
People would, like, attach their door cameras to it and stuff. This is a long time ago. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Before it just became normal for your whole life to be streamed and it was still creepy. Yeah.
Oh, God. It was. It was created in 2007, but dissolved in 2014. That's right. Yeah, can broadcast online. Anyone can broadcast online. I brought up the Wikipedia article. Yeah. It was basically YouTube before YouTube. Right.
Wild.
Yeah.
Wait, what do you mean before YouTube? 2007? YouTube was like 2004,
I think.
Oh, wow. Hold on. So I was right. Justin TV is Twitch's
grandfather.
Grandfather, yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Wow. You know, that's fun podcasting stuff when you're literally bringing up Wikipedia and reading directly from it for people that, those that are listening. It's a great way to do it.
Maybe that's our new direction. We'll just be JJ Googling things and reading Wikipedia entries to it.
Well, I just Googled his answers to the CNCF stuff, so I think it's not far off. Like, what's more relatable in the tech industry than let me Google that for you?
Right.
That's true.
The show. Well, it's almost weekend time. Any good plans for any of you guys this weekend?
I think I'm going to have a pretty quiet one. I did a lot of cooking last weekend. I smoked a couple of Wagyu briskets. I made some fermented tomatoes. I think I'm supposed to say them here. I smoked and sun-dried chilies, which I then rehydrated and then started fermenting. And so I'm going to see how they show up. I did...
Oh, question.
Oh,
about yes. Dehydration. Yes.
Yeah.
So I just learned yesterday. Well, not yesterday, but I actually used it yesterday. My little air fryer thing has a dehydration setting. Sure. So I had some Thai chilies that I'm growing in my backyard. They're turned red. So I put them in there to dehydrate them overnight, pretty much. Did it for like 6 hours at 150 degrees. Now, do I cut off the tops now and throw that into a coffee grinder? And now is that how I make a quote unquote spice, or is there more stuff I need to do?
No, that's it.
That's it.
Often you'll often deseed them.
That takes all the fun out of it.
Well, you look at like a chili powder and they don't usually have seeds in them, right?
They're not seedy. They're not you, JJ. Right.
That's true.
Yeah. And so one of the ways you can do that is like cut them into like three or four pieces, stick them in something and just shake the hell out of it, and then like dump them onto like a wire rack that's big enough to hold the slices of chili but not big enough but the seeds will fall through, and that'll take care of most of the seeds.
Okay.
So your brisket looked amazing, Paul. And I think this is a good private place for us to talk about your mean DM to me after. Uh-oh. I was so excited. I have done a really good job at indirectly cooking. I did a reverse sear on some ribeye that went really well. That was
nice. Good man.
Then I did pork tenderloin after dry burning it, and it was with hardcore carnivore red seasoning, and it was just absolute magic.
The best.
So freaking good. So then I messaged Paul, I'm like, after seeing his Wagyu, I'm like, I should smoke a brisket. I think I'm gonna dive into that. And it was just like, whoa, buddy, you're not there yet. So could you please elaborate for us on what credentialing I need to get to?
Well, it's not about credentialing. It's about...
You need to join the community first.
It's about your level of, like, just... Yeah.
Like, show up to a few zooms.
It's like, walk before you run. Like, if you want
to
make a
brisket... Get out of your metaphors and get to the point.
And go ahead and make a brisket. But you'll probably be disappointed in it.
Yeah. No, so
it's not going to come out like animal barbecue or whatever they are.
Are you talking about dinosaur barbecue? Or animales?
Yeah, okay. That's the one.
Yeah, animales is the one in Minneapolis.
Like you won't pull out a brisket that tastes like his, right?
Right.
Because
I'm just not good enough.
It's like bowling.
Have you done a 12-hour smoke on your...
Did a 6 hour and it was
right
horrifically long.
Right. So yes. That's like, you want to work your way up. So you've done ribs. Like ribs are a good starter. Pulled pork is great because it's super forgiving. And then beef ribs are really good as well.
Beef ribs are goddamn delicious. I actually think they're better than brisket.
I agree.
Yes.
If you give me the choice to eat a good piece of brisket or a good piece of beef rib, I'll probably take the beef rib.
So what's
it's all the good things about the brisket. It's just smaller, so it's quicker.
Okay, so it's really a time factor, and like keeping things on temperature for that length of time is an advanced skill.
Yes. And the other thing you have with the brisket is it has two very distinct halves that cook very differently.
Oh, I didn't know
that. So you've got the flat and the point, right? Mm-hmm. And so the point is the fatty end of the brisket that has a fat seam in the middle. It has like the point is sort of the bottom half of it until it tapers off. And not only do they cook at different times and need a different temperature, but they have a different grain. So when you're slicing it, you slice up the flat until you get to a certain point, and then you have to switch and basically do it from 90 degrees to do the to the point. So it's a brisket is about the most technical thing you can smoke, not just from smoking, but also from the cutting and the preparation. So I'm more interested in like giving you good experiences and letting you learn through good experiences versus like
having a 10-pound chunk of meat that I want to throw out.
Right. Mm-hmm. Like going to Top Golf and like swinging straight for the back net.
Yeah, that all very valid points. I knew it was coming from a place of guru shift, as you have been my meat Sherpa. Ooh, that's not gonna bode well for in the cut. But anyway, being my Sherpa of sorts through this practice. So fair enough. I think I was gonna. I'm thinking about doing some pork ribs again because I only did them really good the second time when I used the cherry wood to smoke it and started to figure out like how to grid the briquette so that it like slowly burned and like could self-manage for 6+ hours.
Yep. And that's the key, right? If you need to learn your smoker and like one good protein so that every time you make ribs, you want them to come out at like 90% of the best you've ever done.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like being able to pull out ribs like that and make them almost perfect every time, that's like way better than like trying some brisket, now trying this thing, and it's getting like, you know, not great, like probably still tasty, but not great, like excellent results for each. So like I am a big fan of like working your way up through those things. Now, do I practice what I preach? Fuck no.
Oh, you're off the deep end of practice though. It's not a, right. I don't think people that don't follow you on Instagram know just quite how much you cook and how diverse and how good it all looks.
Yeah. I guess I'm at that point where I've got enough of the like muscle memory and stuff that I can attack most things and have a pretty good chance of success.
Yeah.
But again, like if I had your grill, I would definitely not try brisket myself for quite some time because your grill cooks way, way differently to stuff I've used.
Right. Yeah. I think I would want to wait for like a real smoker. Plus just takes my time. But JJ, what were you saying?
Yeah. I do want to throw in just for how much money you were going to spend on a brisket, right? I would actually, this is how I think, is I would actually spend that money on doing like a nice beef tenderloin instead. Which if you do it like you said, you're doing some reverse sears already and you felt very confident doing that, doing a reverse sear of a tenderloin and then pairing it with a nice glass of red wine, yes, you're not going to have 10 pounds of meat and it's going to be significantly smaller, but you will remember that steak, especially with that red a hardcore carnivore red. If you do the like the crusty one, like the crust amount of on it on both sides, you will be like, you'll come back in a couple of weeks and be like, JJ, okay, it's understandable that you're nowhere near Paul, but that was a damn good idea.
Thank you. Good. No, it's a great point when talking about the price points on these things and also, just the satisfaction level of doing it right. Mm-hmm. I like that message. So getting that perfect crust at the end, like do you have to like really ramp up the temperature to kind of solidify things at the end, or like how do you finish a good steak?
I in my mouth, I put it, pick it up and put it in my mouth and I eat it.
Depends on the girth, either one or two hands.
There you go. There it is. So no joke. I've actually been struggling with this myself recently. Because as we talked in a previous episode, I actually do use my sous vide to make steaks, when I'm either being lazy or I want to really like, make sure there's the perfect temperature inside of it.
Mm-hmm. Totally. That's fair.
Yeah. So what I do is I have a gas grill on my porch outside right by my kitchen where I turn it as hot as it can be. And then I sear it for a minute and a half. My target temperature inside from the sous vide is 120, believe it or not, because I know that the searing on the grill for a minute and a half on each side, because that's kind of where I get the color that I'm looking for, and also the fat. I usually do New York strips. The fat actually starts caramelizing. Yeah. That it'll jump maybe about to 135, not usually higher than that if I'm doing it for that 1 minute 30 seconds each side. And also, I've noticed that when I do that, my gas grill gets really flamey, is how I describe it, because all the juices go everywhere and it starts catching, and it's like 800 degrees, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm gonna die. According to some things I've been reading, I should actually do it in a cast iron inside of that, so all the fat gets caught in the cast iron, so it doesn't go dripping down or whatever. But I haven't actually tried that. So to answer your question in a very long roundabout way, I'm still learning that myself.
Cool.
Yeah. So the hottest thing you can get with the most surface area contact.
Me.
Is
the hottest. Come on. Most. What you want, come on.
Right. So the real reason you do cast iron is you can get it like rip roaring hot, and it like really retains that heat. So when you put the steak on it, the steak isn't going to cool it down a ton, like suddenly taking in all that heat. Right. Mm-hmm. But the other reason is all the flavor from searing it is all about the Maillard reaction, which is not caramelization. That's a whole other topic we don't need to get into. But
is it the blacking, the blacking of the fat is not caramelization. It's
the browning of it. So the Maillard reaction.
Maillard. Oh, did not know that.
So when you're browning a steak, when you're searing a steak, when you're cooking toast, it turns brown, like, the browning of the toast is because of the Maillard reaction, right? Whereas caramelization is very specific to sugar.
Oh, didn't they talk about this in Salt Acid?
Probably.
Heat, Yahtzee, whatever the, Salt Acid.
Yeah, I think they might have.
It's a great, great miniseries on Netflix about food. But okay, cool. Yeah. Keep going, Paul.
Yeah, Harold McGee talks about it in his book as well, which is like on science and cooking, which is like the Bible for like, it was like the real first like combination of like science and cooking in
book. So he's before Alton Brown?
Oh yeah, yeah, long before Alton Brown.
There is no one before Alton Brown.
There is only AB, there's no BB.
Exactly. Alton Brown. Then Josh Wiseman comes along, right?
You know what?
Yeah, I know.
I wanted to strangle that guy watching him massacre that Alpha store.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
He's gone very mainstream. He very much has. What the hell are you talking about?
I didn't want to ask, but now I need to know.
The worst thing about that guy is he'll make a really complex, convoluted recipe, and he won't actually publish the recipe. So the only way you can make what he does is by rewatching it 10 times and writing it down, which is great for his view count, not so great for my sanity.
Yep. They do on his subreddit though. There are people who actually sit there and transcribe everything, but yeah, you are absolutely like, you have to do so much legwork just to be like, God, really? Oh, ugh.
But here's what I did the other day, which I want to bring up because it's delicious and something anyone can do, is like oven fries. So get your potatoes, like good russet, big russet potatoes, peel them, chop them into like larger than French fries, but not quite like your big fat steak fries. boil them in salty, vinegary water, like a ton of salt, like a couple of tablespoons of vinegar, until they're softened. Let them, like, empty them out, let them dry off, and then crank, then, like, coat them in a fairly highly saturated fat. So, like, a peanut oil, or if you have any animal fat, like beef fat. So, I've got a ton of tallow from smoking briskets. If you, like, keep your chicken fat, schmaltz, how you pronounce it.
Yep.
Even butter works, but you have to be careful about it burning. But you stick in the oven at like 450 degrees or 425 if you're convection, for like 20 minutes, turn them, put them in for another 10, and you will get like oven fries that are better than anything you're bringing out of like a deep fryer at home.
Nice.
Just as good as anything you'd pull out of a air fryer, because they're just ovens anyway. Yeah.
Can I make a request?
Yes.
So I saw a picture of you pulling noodles and you're like, these are, I'm finally learning how to pull noodles.
No. So there's
or are you trolling us?
Noodles? No, but I wasn't talking about hand pulled noodles.
Oh.
There's an Instagram like meme of like pulling the noodles up with your chopsticks and doing a noodle.
Yeah.
Okay. And so I was just kind of like having a bit of a troll of that meme.
Really?
Dude, hand pulled noodles are impossible. You have to like,
it's a daily thing.
Go to China and learn it right. Most of the stuff you get here is still a bit too thick. So there's a compound called pankui, which is made from like burning a particular type of weed until it like carbonizes, and you use that as like a dough conditioner. There is now a chemically created version of that, which is the commonly used, and anywhere in China where they make good hand pulled noodles, they are using that. Mm-hmm. And even using that, it's still really, really hard. So there's a couple of folks that have done like videos on YouTube with really long rest times and with using some other dough conditioners, but most of the time the noodles are still too thick, and like they got lucky once and got a good pull once. They're not really repeatable. Mm. That being said, like you can, if you work at it hard enough and you get enough muscle in your arms and you get a good technique, you could make hand pulled noodles from just flour, water and salt, but you're not going to do that in a couple of weeks, like following YouTube videos. You're going to do it in a couple of years working under a fucking Chinese master noodle maker.
And I think that is the theme
probably
of this
the episode. Most technically challenging food item a person can make.
But I love it. I think this is kind of the full circle of this episode of you need to wade into things, and you won't be fantastic at the beginning, whether that is contributing to open source. You're not going to be on the board of something right away, and you're not going to know what the hell you're doing right away, but do it anyway. Grilling, do it anyway.
Yep.
Noodles, optional.
Well, but noodles, there are plenty of noodles you can make that are not hand-pulled noodles, right?
There you go.
Master every other type of noodle before you try and make hand-pulled noodles. Because if you go straight to the hand-pulled noodles, you'll never want to make noodles ever again, any kind, because you'll be so mad at how frustrating it was.
Love it. Awesome. Well, I'm going to go back to cooking smaller portions of meat. Thank you both for the edification.
Sounds good. Awesome.
Hey, you can also do a prime rib. Is a pretty amazing thing to smoke and then sear at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And then also like a full size pork loin versus the tenderloin.
Interesting.
Both very good options. Often they're sold as like pork roast, and you get them sometimes bone in, normally bone out. They come in like a 3 to 4 pound like section, and that's like another really great thing to learn how to like smoke and cook. Pork belly is also great. If you've never smoked a pork belly, holy shit, they're so good. And then you've got the different got the different variations of like burnt ends, like pot-bellied burnt ends, chuck burnt ends. Like there's so many cool things you can do. And then if you do want to do a brisket, you could do just the flat, and you could even do like the flat, but like brine slash cure it first and actually make it more like a pastrami style, which is a lot more, it's actually more work, but it's actually like easier to get a good result with. Very and then cool. You're ready for St. Patrick's Day.
Just in time. Number one thing on my mind in the year of 2020.
Awesome. Did we already gentlemen. Miss St. Patrick's Day?
Yeah, we did. It was back in March.
Yeah. Aww. Like March 14th or something like that.
Say bye, everybody.
All right. Bye, everybody.
There we go. I was waiting for that.